From Pacifica Network, this is Democracy Now!
There has never been a more specific statement in support of equal rights than is in the Republican platform this year.
Ronald Reagan, Jimmy Carter, Richard Nixon. Today we continue our week-long series, Passel of Pomp, Circus of Circumstance, looking at convention coverage past from the Pacifica Radio Archive. We go from the 1972 conventions to 1980. Then we look at the case of Florida election supervisor Miriam Oliphant. She's taking the stand today in a trial that'll decide whether the Senate should uphold Florida Governor Jeb Bush's decision to suspend her. And we speak with award-winning reporter from the Sydney Morning Herald who broke the story of Iraq's unelected prime minister, saying he shot six Iraqi detainees in cold blood before he was appointed. The reporter has fled Iraq. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Former National Security Advisor Sandy Berger has resigned from his post and as advisor to the Democratic presidential candidate John Kerry. This follows the revelation that Berger's under criminal investigation by the Justice Department over allegations he took secret documents from the National Archives while reviewing Clinton administration records for the 9/11 Commission. Sources said that among the documents Berger took were drafts of a Clinton administration after-action report on efforts to thwart the so-called Millennium Plot, a suspected al-Qaeda attack planned around New Year's holiday in 1999. Berger said in a statement Monday the removal of the papers was unintentional. In a brief statement to reporters Tuesday night, Berger said that while reviewing documents last year, he, quote, made an honest mistake. He said, it's one that I deeply regret. Berger said any suggestion he'd done anything other than try to aid the 9/11 Commission is simply absolutely wrong. Law enforcement sources said archive staff members told FBI agents they saw Berger placing items in his jacket and pants. One archive staffer told agents Berger also placed something in his socks. That latter allegation drew a sharp response from Berger associate former White House lawyer Lanny Davis, who challenged any unnamed official who makes such an accusation to come forward publicly. Davis said, quote, I suggest that person is lying. And if that person has the guts, he said, let's see who it is who made the comment that Sandy Berger stuffed something into his socks. Berger was designated as the official from the Clinton administration who would review documents relevant to 9/11 Commission inquiries into the terrorist attacks of September 11th. He also was a witness at the commission hearings and reviewed records to prepare for his personal testimony. The U.S. military death toll since the start of the operations in Iraq reached 900 this morning when one soldier was killed north of Baghdad, six others wounded in a roadside bomb explosion. Two Marines and two soldiers have also been killed since Monday in the western Al-Anbar province. Top Halliburton executives asked to testify before the House Government Reform Committee tomorrow refused to appear to answer questions about the company's contracting services in Iraq. Instead, Halliburton will send executives lower down in the chain of command. This will be the first time Halliburton officials have gone before a congressional panel to discuss the company's performance. Four whistleblowers will also appear before the panel to explain their charges against the company, including that personnel were ordered to abandon an $85,000 truck because of a flat tire. The Filipino truck driver held hostage in Iraq for 2 weeks in his home in Manila yesterday after the Philippines vowed to withdraw its entire force from the country. Meanwhile, Japan has said it will keep its 550 non-combat troops in Iraq despite threats this week from a group claiming links to al-Qaeda. A defense ministry spokesperson said yesterday, quote, Russia's position remains unchanged. We are not going to send Russian military personnel to conflict zones in Afghanistan or Iraq, either for free or in exchange for economic benefits, he said. The Texas-based private consulting group Strategic Forecasting published analysis this week saying Moscow and Washington are discussing a Bush administration request for Russia to send troops to one of two hotspots this fall. Under intense pressure from the United States, Greece has said it'll allow 400 American Special Forces soldiers to be present at the Olympic Games next month and will also permit U.S., Israeli, and possibly British security officers to carry weapons. The decision represents a significant departure from Olympic tradition, as well as from Greek law, which prohibits foreign personnel from carrying weapons within the country. Until now, the only nation known to have armed its security forces at the Olympics is Israel, whose agents have been carrying arms largely without prior approval from host countries since 1972, when a Palestinian group killed Israeli athletes and officials in the Olympic Village in Munich. In addition to the special forces, the agreements call for 100 armed U.S. agents to be used largely as bodyguards for U.S. athletes and dignitaries. The FBI is also sending a hostage rescue team, as well as evidence gathering and analysis personnel who will be pressed into service in the event of an attack. A U.S. law enforcement official said these officers would also be armed. A six-month examination by the New York Times reveals several financial services companies have been targeting soldiers on U.S. military bases attempting to sell insurance policies and investments. The Times found insurance agents have made misleading pitches to, quote, captive audiences on bases, and that they've posed as counselors on veteran benefits and independent financial advisors. And they've solicited soldiers in their barracks or while they're on duty in violation of Pentagon regulations. The New York Times says the problem has intensified since the beginning of the Iraq War, with the death toll rising in Iraq, interest in insurance among the troops has surged, making the war a selling opportunity for many agents. To reach the buyers, many companies have used their military connections to lend credibility to their sales efforts. The advisory board at one company, First Command Financial Planning in Fort Worth, includes General Anthony Zinni, the retired commander-in-chief of the United States Central Command. Pennsylvania Congressmember Joe Huffel and political comedian and activist Dick Gregory were arrested yesterday in a protest outside the Sudanese embassy in Washington, D.C. They were arrested as part of a campaign calling on the U.N. Security Council to impose sanctions on Sudan and suspend the country's membership at the U.N. Human Rights Commission. An investigator for the animal rights group PETA captured video showing chickens being kicked, stomped, and thrown against a wall by workers at a supplier for Kentucky Fried Chicken, which has been under pressure since last year over the treatment of animals. Officials from Yum Brands, Inc., which owns the fast food chain, said the employee or employees responsible will be terminated. The footage was secretly taken at a plant in West Virginia by a PETA activist who worked there from October to May. The PETA organization says its investigator also obtained eyewitness testimony about employees ripping birds' beaks off, spray painting their faces, twisting their heads off, spitting tobacco into their mouths and eyes, and breaking the birds in half, all while they were still alive. PETA said it planned to ask West Virginia authorities to prosecute plant employees and managers under state animal cruelty laws. And this news from Florida, a lesbian couple who married in Massachusetts sued the federal government to have their union legally recognized in the rest of the country. The couple, the Reverend Nancy Wilson and Paula Schoenwither, married on July 2nd. They applied for a marriage license in Florida afterward and were denied. The lawsuit names Attorney General John Ashcroft and a county clerk. And finally, pop music singer Linda Ronstadt was fired from an engagement at the Aladdin Casino in Las Vegas on Saturday after praising Michael Moore's film Fahrenheit 9/11. Ronstadt dedicated her encore finale of the Eagles' song Desperado to Michael Moore, whom she described as a, quote, great American patriot who is spreading the truth. Some members of the audience booed the comment and walked out of the show, while others cheered.
On the oceans and upon our seas, fish full of mercury. Oh, oh, mercy, mercy me. All things ain't what they used to be. Radiation underground and in the sky. Animals and birds who live nearby are nice.
Welcome to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Suspended Florida election supervisor Miriam Oliphant will take the stand today in her own defense to decide whether the Florida Senate should uphold Governor Jeb Bush's decision to suspend her. Bush suspended Oliphant last year without pay for alleged neglect of duty, incompetence, and malfeasance stemming from a 2002 gubernatorial primary. Broward County voters received bad ballots and inaccurate registration information. In addition, some polls opened late, others closed early. Thousands of votes were not counted properly. The election raised questions about the vote counting and reporting process for the county's $17.2 million ES&E electronic voting system, which Oliphant had initially opposed. Broward's also the county whose votes were ordered not to be counted by the Supreme Court of the United States in the 2000 presidential election. Oliphant was elected by 70% of the vote in 2000, becoming the first African-American constitutional supervisor of elections in Broward County. She filed papers last week announcing her intent to run for supervisor again. We asked whether Governor Jeb Bush's office would join us on this conversation today, but they said they had no one who would comment on the case on Democracy Now! Today. We are joined, though, on the telephone by Miriam Oliphant, who is the Broward County election supervisor, by Henry Hunter, her attorney, and by Seville Brown, Florida president of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference. Miriam Oliphant, you are set to go on the stand today. What are you going to say?
Well, good morning. I really appreciate you allowing me to come on and speak to the whole world this morning. I have an opportunity to face my accusers. These are the Broward County Commissioners, the Governor of the State of Florida, as well as Glenda Hood, the Secretary of State, who falsely accused me of wrongdoing and neglect of my duties. And these officers are under subpoena. They are refusing to show up and testify. And I think that it's wrong. They have sabotaged my elections. They have conspired against me. And I think I have the right to face my accusers. And that is what should happen today. And we are very much concerned because the testimony that have been given in the courtroom have shown that people were responsible for duties and they neglected their duties, and they should be held accountable as well.
What about the charges that the governor, Jeb Bush, is making, saying that Broward County voters receive bad ballots and inaccurate registration information, that some polls opened late, others closed early, and that thousands of votes were not counted properly?
Again, Governor Bush is making false accusations against me. The information that has been provided to the courtroom is not the information that the governor has cited me for. As a constitutional officer, he has illegally suspended me in a very malicious way. People have responsibilities, you know, over the poll workers department, missing ballots, you know. These people were fired by me and rehired by my replacement. I think Governor Bush need to testify. He needs to come into the courtroom under oath, the Secretary of State, come into the courtroom under the oath, and the county commissioners. All of them, you know, file these accusations. I think that I have the right to face my accusers, and that way the record is clear and the voters that voted for me will have an opportunity to know exactly what happened. They need to know the truth, and the governor need to be questioned by the charges that he has filed against me.
Seville Brown, you're the president of the Florida chapter of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference. Why have you gotten involved with Miriam Oliphant's case?
The Southern Christian Leadership Conference in Florida, basically after ascertaining and evaluating most of the facts as opposed to those illusionary allegations that were made, came to a conclusion that there was ample merit that basically Oliphant was falsely accused, and we just applaud her Herculean efforts to not let them break her spirit with a smear campaign that reaches from South Florida all the way to Tallahassee to the governor. And our concern is encapsulated in the fact that here you have a supervisor of election officer that within a year and a half of taking on her duties after getting elected in the infamous 2000 election, she registered some 300,000 plus people, 80% of which were Democrat. Understanding it's a simple matter of math. Broward County, the same county that was stopped by the Supreme Court of counting their ballots, basically could have made the difference in terms of who was the president of the United States. And here we have that same county now with an aggressive supervisor of election of color for historically for the first time. And she has 300,000 people now registered, and there was a differential of only 500 and something votes. So the fact that the Broward County Commissioners, chaired by Lori Parrish and others, have connections with cronies in the state legislature that are tied to the election machines and the bid for those machines that were put forward, Oliphant, the crime that she is guilty of is not playing ball and not compromising herself and becoming corrupt. She stayed firm, and she stayed firm on the issue from day one. And so the thing that we are very concerned about that America needs to see, and we wish that this could have been aired on court TV, where the false allegations are being put to rest under cross-examination, and even their state witnesses are having to say out of their own mouths that Miriam Oliphant was competent. And it's a shame to say that that the rest of the country might be facing another fiasco in 2004 in November of this year if we don't do something in terms of all the civil rights organizations, all those watchdog national umbrella entities that need to come in and see in the next 105 days as we're counting down. This Secretary of State has done nothing now to do anything about those E&S machines that they have there that are flawed in Broward County and that seven other counties are having to deal with, and we are 105 days away from the election, and the Secretary of State has not moved. So SCLC is very concerned that America needs to basically put on its seatbelt and brace themselves for another major political debacle in Florida if something is not done. And that's why we were calling on the governor to take emergency measures and issue an emergency executive order under 5 points that would make sure that he would appoint a Florida Elections Commission with authority to take any and all actions to assure a fair, full, and free vote for all Floridians. And to this point, we are outraged at the fact that the Secretary of State is fighting to testify today, not to take the stand today. The Broward County Commissioners, with all the corruption that permeates that commission down there, even it permeates the media down there, they were able to escape getting on the stand and testifying, where the truth would come out, and all of the shenanigans, all of the political mayhem, all of this cronyism that involves money, and basically they wanted to use Miriam Oliphant as a scapegoat and smeared her name, coloring her because she's African American, and saying that she was an up and comer. And the listening audience needs to understand this.
Let me bring Henry Hunter into this conversation,
yes,
who is representing Miriam Oliphant. Why did you want Glenda Hood, who replaced Catherine Harris as Secretary of State, to testify in this, and how unusual is this state Senate hearing?
Well, this state Senate hearing is probably the first one since 1986, and I think there's about two before then. And it's unprecedented. There's no statutory authority to form an assessment team by the Division of Elections and go into a supervisor's office for purposes of assessing the office. They went in to pretend to offer Ms. Oliphant assistance and afterwards came back with a recommendation of suspension because of their recommendation. Now, recommendation has never been the basis of suspending anybody in Florida ever. Number two, she's been exonerated for any crime. She has been systematically audited. She's a constitutional officer that's been audited by the Broward County auditors at least 4 or 5 times. She had the constitutional office. The first effort was made to not make it a constitutional office by going to charter review. And the Broward County Supervisor of Elections office is a plum. It is a pearl of the county because it's the highest paid elected supervisor's office. It has more voters now. And Ms. Oliphant and redistricting came up to 1 million people. I think what you have here is some of her peer review. Ms. Oliphant is a very attractive African-American female, and she didn't fit into the clique. And they went down to call themselves getting her election ready. She's run 13 successful elections since the September primary. And this election, the special election for which they suspended her, she's run elections in that area before. But the peculiar part about it is that she's not charged with any one particular act. They've made an allegation of incompetence, which sounds to the public like she's dumb, an inability to run the job. But incompetence, statutorily defined, is a physical inability that occurs after you're in office. If you don't have a physical disability to perform your job, but then the voters voted her in, 500,000 voters. And the community is very proud. They have the first black constitutional office, probably the most politically influential office down there, being supervisor of election, in view of the fact that she has contact with all of the voters. We feel, for whatever reason that they have here, it was a reason that's not within the Constitution, it's not within the statutes of the state of Florida, and we feel that it's a personal jealousy, it's an effort to go down and feel that here's this black female can't have the ability to run this job. But what they realized is that she had an exceptional amount of backup. She outsourced everything that they're complaining about and then finally fired. Everything was fine with her until she fired two particular employees, that's Mary Hall and Pat Nesbitt, for fussing over poll workers and absentee ballots. And this is a crucial area because these are the two people that caused her the greatest problems. When she fired these two people, one with a high school education, the other one didn't finish college, but had been there for a while, That's when she was fired. And they brought these two individuals back, and I can't understand that for the life of me.
How unusual is it that an elected official is suspended without criminal charges being brought against them?
Highly unusual. Almost unheard of.
We have to break, and then when we come back, I want to ask Miriam Oliphant, one, about the voting machines and why you oppose the ES&E voting machines. And then, even though you're going through this hearing, you are now going to run again to be the elected elections supervisor. Stay with us.
Okay. Thank you.
This is Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report, democracynow.org, the largest public media collaboration in the country, broadcasting on over 240 radio and television stations, Pacifica and NPR stations, public access TV stations, PBS on Free Speech TV, Channel 9415 of Dish Network, and now also on DirecTV on Link TV, Channel 375 of DirecTV. As we continue with this discussion about the Florida election commissioner who is fighting to get her job back in a highly unusual hearing. She was suspended by the Florida governor, Jeb Bush, and she will testify today before the Florida State Senate. Then we go to speak with a reporter who contends that the unelected prime minister of Iraq was involved with the killing of a number of Iraqis. And then we will go to our week-long convention series called Passel of Pomp, Circus of Circumstance. Finally, Miriam Oliphant, this issue of why you opposed the electronic voting machines, the county's $17.2 million electronic voting system.
I opposed that machine because of the fact that the ES&S voting system had never been used in an election. I recommended one that was used in the November 2000 election. Of course, I was opposed by the Broward County Commission. It's their responsibility to purchase and to fund the budget of the Broward County Supervisor of Elections Office. Knowing that this system had never been used, knowing that it was labor-intense, it would require additional workers, additional dollars, additional precincts, and it was just more and more labor-intense. I have to make mention that I am a professional. I'm a college graduate with a master's degree. I've served as an elected official on the Broward County School Board, chaired over a $2 million budget. I've served in, and worked for the Broward County court system as a professional for well over 20 years. For someone to question my competence and my qualification, it really concerns me about the 500,000 voters who elected me in November 2000. And the question of, I registered most voters in the state of Florida. Everything that I have recommended and approved by the community has been overruled by the Broward County Commission as well as the Secretary of State. And again, it concerns me that they have subpoenas. They should be on that stand today to tell their side, why did they, you know, interfere with my operation? Why would they micromanage my office? Why would they overrule me on a voting system that was never used? You know, already the governor of the state of Florida has claimed Broward. There goes Broward for Bush. You know, there goes the state of Florida for Bush. It really concerns me that the people should be alarmed that the fact that the conspiracy has already started before the election in November.
Finally, I wanted to bring Sewell Brown, last 30 seconds back, of the SCLC. Jesse Jackson, the Reverend Jesse Jackson, held a news conference saying a million people were disenfranchised in 2000. Where do you see this story fitting in?
Basically, it bespeaks what Florida represents to the rest of the nation. That's a microcosm of voting problems that will be permeating the system going into the 2004 election. And we are just saying, with 105 days left and counting down, we cannot allow the flawed voting machines in 17 counties in Florida to stand uncorrected that may again determine an election as was in 2000. And to that end, we know that the Secretary of State cannot simply wash her hands and let each of the 67 counties come up with their own system of determining or removing ineligible voters, because the Supreme Court knocked that down in 2000 when it said that different recount procedures in each county violated the Equal Protection Clause of the Constitution. So right now, Florida basically is a microcosm of the millions of voters, or the hundreds of thousands of votes that can be lost, that Jesse Jackson is, Reverend Jackson is speaking to. And we just hope that the truth will come out, as those in the media like Democracy Now! And others will want to get to the truth and force these county commissioners and this governor and this Secretary of State to get on the witness stand and testify so that the whole world will know what is about to fall.
On that note, Sewell Brown, I want to thank you very much for being with us. Florida President of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, Miriam Elefante, the Broward County Election Supervisor suspended by Governor Jeb Bush, is now today going to testify before the Florida State Senate. And Miriam Elefante's attorney, Henry Hunter. Just to clarify, the election system, the voting machines that she opposed, the Nebraska-based Election Systems and Software, ES&S. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. As we move to an international story, in just 3 weeks in power, Iraq's unelected Prime Minister Iyad Alawi has assumed the power to impose martial law, ban demonstrations, monitor citizens' phones and email. He's praised U.S. airstrikes on Fallujah and threatened to annihilate the country's armed resistance. But the most shocking story appeared last week in the Sydney Morning Herald of Australia, which reported that Alawi personally shot dead six suspected members of the Iraqi resistance at a Baghdad police station just days before he became prime minister. The newspaper based its report on two eyewitnesses who said Alawi used a pistol to execute six prisoners who were handcuffed and blindfolded. Iraq's human rights minister announced he's opening an investigation into the report that Alawi has strongly denied. The story was broken by an award-winning reporter at the Sydney Morning Herald named Paul McGough, who has since left Iraq for his own safety. Welcome to Democracy Now!. Paul McGough,
good afternoon.
It's good to have you with us. Can you tell us exactly what you understand about the Prime Minister Iyad Alawi's involvement, alleged involvement in the killing of six Iraqis?
I have interviewed two people who say they witnessed what happened in a courtyard at the Al Amriya police station. I interviewed them separately. Each did not know that I had spoken to the other. In getting to them, I used only personal channels, so there was no room for people involved in political, military, religious organizations to put a damaging story in place against Alawi. It was their stories were told reluctantly, they were told with fear, and they were also told with a pat on the back to Alawi for having done this, because both witnesses were shared the widely held view of Iraqis that this was a good thing in terms of letting the terrorists, as they call them, know what fate they had. The two stories as told by the witnesses were that Alawi made a surprise visit to this police station at about 10:30 in the morning. All the police on duty were called together. He gave them a pep talk, urging them on to be brave and strong and courageous in their work, go after the terrorists, fight for the new Iraq. And all of this was because of the crisis problems that confront the police in Iraq these days. They're under-trained, they're under-equipped, they have a morale problem, they're under constant fire from the insurgents, they don't know if they're going to be shot in their own homes or if their police stations are going to be blown up. As told to me, after the pep talk, the Prime Minister went on a tour of the police complex. This tour ended up in a small courtyard where the prisoners were lined up against a wall. They were handcuffed. They were blindfolded. While they were against the wall, there was an exchange between the Prime Minister and the Iraqi Interior Minister, who was also present, and also between Alawi and the prisoners. He threw questions at them. You know, why do you do this? Are you with Saddam? Are you fighting with Saddam? Why do you kill Iraqis? He turned to those around him and said, these people are responsible for killing as many as 50 Iraqis each. At that point, the Interior Minister is said to have interjected, saying that he thought that all the prisoners should be killed on the spot. The Prime Minister replied that, no, they deserved worse than death. But having said that, he then pulled a pistol from his belt. Several of the people who were present, were of the view or concluded that this was in fact a Belgian-made Browning pistol that he used. He stood in the one spot. He then moved his outstretched arm through an arc left to right, pausing at each prisoner and shooting them in the head.
This is a story that has gotten front page coverage in your paper, the leading paper of Australia, the Sydney Morning Herald. It's almost got no attention in this country or the British press. Can you explain?
It's a difficult story to get into. The story has been reported quite widely as a story. Newsweek has followed it up. The Toronto Star ran everything in full that I wrote. Several of the British dailies have reported it as an account of my story. But to get into a story like this, you can't do it overnight. It took 3 weeks of work by myself to get to the point where both I and my editors were satisfied that we could publish. To get to witnesses is not easy. So the notion that that somebody could turn around and produce a publishable version of this story for another newspaper or for a TV news bulletin in a 24-hour turnaround just doesn't make sense. I mean, nobody else followed up the My Lai massacre on day two. It just doesn't happen with a major story like this.
I only have a minute, but why have you left Iraq?
I discussed this with a few of my colleagues, and because of the incredible lack of security in Iraq for Westerners, even before you write something such as this, I took their advice and I agreed with it that it was probably in my better interest not to be in Iraq when I published.
I want to thank you very much for joining us, Paul McGough, correspondent for the Sydney Morning Herald, front page story in Australia that the unelected Prime Minister Iyad Alawi shot dead 6 prisoners a few days before he was appointed to his position. And before we go to break and to our week-long convention series, we wanted to play you an interaction between veteran White House correspondent Helen Thomas and White House Press Secretary Scott McClellan.
Prime Minister Blair took full personal responsibility for taking his nation into war under falsehoods, and now under reasons that have been determined now to be false. Is President Bush also willing to take full personal...
I think Prime Minister Blair said that it was the right thing to do, that Saddam Hussein's regime was a threat.
Those were not the reasons he took his country into war. They have turned out to be untrue, and the same is true for us.
Yeah,
as the President and take full personal responsibility.
The issue here is what do you do with a threat in a post-September 11th world? Either you live with a threat or you confront the threat.
There was no threat.
The president made the decision to confront the threat.
Saddam Hussein did not threaten this country.
The world, the Congress, and the administration all disagree. They all recognize that there is a threat posed by Saddam Hussein. When it came to September 11th, that changed the equation. It taught us, as I said...
The committee said there was no threat.
As I said, it taught us that we must confront threats before it's too late.
So the president doesn't take
the full responsibility. The president already talked about the responsibility for the decisions he's made. He talked about that with Prime Minister Blair.
Personal responsibility.
Go ahead, Terry, go ahead. Yeah. And then go.
Veteran White House correspondent Helen Thomas questioning White House Press Secretary Scott McClellan. Helen Thomas has been covering U.S. presidents for more than half a century. This is Democracy Now! When we come back, our convention coverage. Stay with us.
Here's to the state of Richard Nixon. For underneath his borders, the devil draws no line. If you drag his muddy rivers and nameless bodies, you will find. And the fat trees of the forest have hid a thousand crimes. And the calendar is lying when it reads the present time. Oh, here's to the land you've torn out the heart of. Richard Nixon, find yourself another country to be part of. And here's to the schools of Richard Nixon, where they're teaching all the children that they don't have to care. All the rudiments of hatred are present everywhere. And every single classroom is a factory of despair. Oh, there's nobody learning such a foreign word as fair.
Oh. Phil Oakes here on Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. As we continue our week-long series we did in collaboration with the Pacifica Radio Archives, looking at conventions past, Passel of Pomp, Circus of Circumstance. In the last hour, we left off in Chicago, 1968. Violence ensued outside the convention halls, and a great dissatisfaction with the Democratic candidate was felt inside. As a result, the Democratic Party sought to find another way to choose a candidate, one less controversial. And so, under the leadership of George McGovern, a commission came up with the primary election. This would allow a candidate to be determined before anyone ever set foot inside a convention hall. Any controversy would take place miles and miles away. And so, in 1972, in Miami, both the Republicans and the Democrats meet in this city, both using the same primary election system. The third-rate burglary at the Watergate was a little more than 2 months old when the Republicans meet in Miami to reaffirm President Nixon in August. The convention is carefully and literally scripted. It's designed to give Nixon the best possible exposure, with almost no worries as to whether Nixon and Agnew will be reelected in November. It is a passel of pomp and a circus of circumstance. Everyone moves through the motions. Nixon and Agnew are nominated. Then Nixon takes the stage and turns to the one issue to which he is sensitive in the field of foreign policy.
Standing in this convention hall 4 years ago, I pledged to seek an honorable end to the war in Vietnam. We have made great progress toward that end. We have brought over 500,000 men home, and more will be coming home. We have ended America's ground combat role. No draftees are being sent to Vietnam. We have reduced our casualties by 98%. We've gone the extra mile. In fact, we've gone tens of thousands of miles trying to seek a negotiated settlement of the war. We have offered a ceasefire, a total withdrawal of all American forces, an exchange of all prisoners of war, internationally supervised free elections with the communists participating in the elections and in the supervisions. There are things, however, that we have not and that we will not offer. We will never abandon our prisoners of war.
Although Nixon felt he was doing well enough on the Vietnam issue, just outside the convention hall, thousands gathered to protest the president, the system, the delegates, and the war. Pacifica reporters Mad Dog Lubowski and Gavin Duffy put together this post-convention show, Bad Moon Over Miami.
This is one of the nation's get in that gate. As you ride into town, Mrs. Nixon, you will see signs all along the way saying you're in Nixon country.
One of the convention delegates has been sprayed with red paint.
There's only one burlesque house, and that's the Gaiety Theater in the whole city of Miami Beach.
And none of the Republicans are coming down too.
That's right.
You have any idea why?
We have the queen of burlesque here, Miss Tempest Storm. If that can bring him in, there's nothing we can do or say anything about.
We're here to bring God back to America.
How do you want to end the Vietnam War? You think we should just kill him?
See, the kill him or be killed. In war, war is war.
It was nomination night, and Lester Lannan and his orchestra were swinging and swaying to the strains of Happy Days Are Here Again, as the Republican delegates were swooning over the personage of their fearless leader, Richard Nixon, who arrived at the poem Watery-Eyed. Watery-eyed not so much because he was all choked up with emotion, but because he too was tear-gassed. Yes, Happy Days were there again, but only inside the convention hall under the glare of the television lights. The scene was much more macabre outside the hall under the glare of the bad moon over Miami.
And the convention delegates are coming back again, and there's a police escort here to take them in through the demonstrators. The convention delegates are now making their way through the demonstrators with a police escort.
It exploded in their lap, but the police are retaliating, and we seem to have a pretty sophisticated game of stickball going on.
What has happened is demonstrators have been caught at either end of the street. The highway patrol has cut off Washington Street, and making it impossible for demonstrators to move down Washington Street towards the convention hall, the front entrances to the convention hall.
You in the purple trousers, is about that close. First here, over this way.
The presidency of the Nixon administration will last a little less than 2 years. In 1974, Vice President Spiro T. Agnew will resign. On August 8, 1974, Richard Nixon will become the first president to resign his office. He will be succeeded by his chosen successor, Gerald R. Ford, the only man to have ever served as both vice president and as president without having been elected to either office.
Is Jimmy Carter inevitable? Inevitable? Inevitable?
This is the question Pacifica reporter Charles Bell asked on Pacifica station WPFW in early 1976. Bell had followed former Governor Carter on the campaign trail, reporting back his observations of the candidate.
Having seen him in action here and in Illinois, after talking with his staff and with members of the ever-increasing press contingent that follows his burgeoning campaign, I think perhaps he may be. A few things, at least, can be said for certain. Carter is a superbly effective campaigner, one whose style and whose message are uniquely suited to this particular era in American politics and society. And he is also a politician blessed with that most intangible but most important element in the construction of political success, luck.
As inconceivable as it was only months before, it seemed Charles Bell's prediction would come to pass. But what else contributed to Carter's rise? During the previous years, the news had been dominated by controversial court rulings, including the exoneration of Ohio Governor James Rhodes and 27 Ohio National Guardsmen in the shootings of 13 Kent State students in May 1970, as well as two landmark Supreme Court rulings in early 1973, the liberal decision of Roe v. Wade in January, and the conservative ruling by 6-3 in March, upholding a lower court ruling allowing states to outlaw homosexual acts, even if committed in private by consenting adults. According to the New York Times, in early 1976, joblessness in the Big Apple reaches 12.2%. The state of Massachusetts' unemployment rate hits 11.8%. In theaters across the country that spring, reflecting possibly the mood of the country, are Academy Award-nominated films One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, Dog Day Afternoon, Stanley Kubrick's Barry Lyndon, and Taxi Driver, all films about someone bucking the system, doing it differently. And it seemed the country wanted someone different, too. In November, Carter takes the election. Despite his contagious optimism, not to mention the fact the Democrats control both the House and the Senate at the time of his election, Carter finds out the rules of insider Washington politics the hard way. Carter promised during the campaign to reduce arms production in the world, but during his presidency, arms production actually went up. Carter placed solar panels on the White House, but what the country remembers of his presidency is the OPEC energy crisis and the long, long lines at the pumps. In 1979, the Soviet Union invades Afghanistan, and of course, Iran takes 66 Americans hostage. By the time 1980 comes around, it seems the country again wants change, this time replacing the independent outsider with someone who represents the influential insider world of money and politics, which would signify an entire decade.
Reagan was telling reporters today that he had considered for many long hours former President Ford as a running mate. Reagan says that it was Ford's decision that he could best help the party by not being a candidate, but a campaigner.
Pacifica reporter Wendell Harper.
It was Ford's instinct, says Reagan, not to become involved in a political battle for the presidential ticket. George Bush, on the other hand, is in the somewhat unusual position of having run against Reagan and now having to run with him. His platform seems to have changed quite a bit. He's no longer for the Equal Rights Amendment, as the women's movement had suggested, but he is now for, quote, equal rights. He's also anti-abortion. And Reagan added his own thoughts to the difference between the Equal Rights Amendment and the party's platform plank.
You see, there is no disagreement, and anyone who reads that plank in the platform recognizes that there has never been a more specific statement in support of equal rights than is in the Republican platform this year. The only difference of opinion that took place in framing the platform was one of how best to achieve equal rights, whether by statute and law or whether by amendment.
But reporters refused to let George Bush off the hook, recalling his denunciations of Reagan's proposed tax cut legislation.
Listen, let me enthusiastically support the proposal that Governor Reagan made in terms of taxes and that was introduced, incidentally, in the House by, I don't want to go back into when we were on opposite sides, but by Barbara Conable, the ranking member of the Ways and Means Committee, who strongly now, having failed in his support, but strongly supports Governor Reagan. And you look at that, and I see a tax bill and a tax proposal that has my enthusiastic support. And there are things in there that I strongly urge. And Governor Reagan had emphasis on other things. But the fact that we both recognize that cutting taxes is the way to help people and to stimulate production is the important thing. And please do not try to keep reminding me of differences I had. I want to get there on the same wavelength and go forward together. And that's what I'm going to do.
So what remains, it seems, is the question of what the far right will do now that Bush, the nominee they vehemently protested, is the nominee they're perhaps stuck with. But it seems pretty clear that unity is not the order at the moment for the Republican Party. For Pacifica, this is Wendell Harper at the Republican National Convention in Detroit.
During 1980, Pacifica hit its stride in covering party conventions with booths at both conventions and live coverage throughout each.
Mark, we have a tape up on the machine that will change the tone quite a bit, and we think maybe we'd share it with you now. It is Ralph Nader shortly after Three Mile Island having a few words to say about Jimmy Carter.
The question is not, can we find other ways to meet our electricity needs? The question is, can enough people in this country roll up their sleeves and go to work as citizens to mobilize an undeniable power that reverberates from California to New York and from Sacramento to Washington? The issue now is political. We were told in 1976 by candidate Jimmy Carter that he would never lie to us and never deceive us. You remember he called atomic energy the last resort. You remember he called he called solar energy and conservation of energy the first resort. Well, after watching him for almost 2.5 years, can we conclude other than he has deceived us? Has he deceived us? Has he lied to us? You remember what he told us when he raised those words? He said that if he ever deceives us and if he ever lies to us, he wants us to vote against him.
Pacifica's coordinated coverage that year took the listener from inside the convention walls to the likes of independent voices like Ralph Nader.
That's about it for now. We go back up to the press area with Mark and Eileen.
United States James Earl Carter. This has got to be one of the president's happiest moments in a long time. Since November, the president has been in the hot seat. He's been attacked by Kennedy. Finally, before the Democrats tonight, he's number one.
Mark, he's been pacing around in that podium area almost like he's a boxer in a ring and sort of enjoying
the crowd.
He's been waving from the podium, and here he is about to speak.
Thank you all very much. Thank you. Fellow Democrats, fellow citizens, I thank you for the nomination you've offered me. And I especially thank you for choosing as my running mate the best partner any president ever had, Fritz Mondale. With gratitude and with determination, I accept your nomination. And I am proud to run on the progressive and sound platform that you have hammered out at this convention.
That would be Carter's last victory. In November, Ronald Reagan and George H.W. Bush will soundly defeat Carter and Walter Mondale. Passel of Pomp, Circus of Circumstance, Pacifica Radio Archives coverage of conventions past. Produced, executive producer Brian DeShazer in the Pacifica Radio Archives, Christopher Sprinkle, writer and producer, technical director Mark Torres, also Sean Dellis, Andrea Hull, John Hamilton produces for television. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Sharif Abdelkaddous, Anna Nagar, Elizabeth Press, Jeremy Scahill, Nell Geiser. If you'd like a copy of today's show, you can call 1-800-881-2359. 1-800-881-2359. Our website, democracynow.org, and the Pacifica Radio Archives website, pacificaradioarchives.org. Tonight, I'll be in Atlanta at the Martin Luther King Chapel, Morehouse College. Friday night, Provincetown, Massachusetts at Provincetown Hall with Norman Mailer. Saturday night, Boston. And next week, Nantucket. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.